dominance that took place after 9/11 was years away. In the years between that triumph in Bosnia and Holbrooke's next attempt to end a war, the United States' place in the world would change dramatically. Afghanistan and Pakistan were at the epicenter of those changes. Before the 9/11 attacks, the CIA had already collaborated with Pakistan in efforts to capture Osama bin Laden. And so it was little surprise that afterwards, the United States took a narrow, tactical approach, working through Pakistan's military and intelligence agency. By the morning of September 12, 2001, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage was meeting with General Mahmoud Ahmed, the Director General of the ISI, attempting to lock down Pakistan's support for American retaliation in Afghanistan. Mahmoud pledged that support and an end to Pakistani collaboration with the Taliban to Armitage. Musharraf did the same to Colin Powell. Just like that, Pakistan went from foe to friend again. Sanctions that had accumulated over Pakistan's nuclear program and Musharraf's coup evaporated. I called President Musharraf after we suggested it was time to make a strategic decision to move away from support for the Taliban, Powell later said, and he reversed the direction in which Pakistan was moving. This was wishful, if not magical, thinking. The ISI had spent the years leading up to 9/11 pumping money, arms, and advisors into Afghanistan to prop up the Taliban and vanquish its enemies, including the coalition of warlords known as the Northern Alliance, which received support from India. When the United States' demands for cooperation rolled in after 9/11, Musharraf assembled his war room, stacked with generals notorious for championing the Taliban and other Islamist militant groups, and decided to unequivocally accept all U.S. demands, but then later, not necessarily agree with all the details, as one attendee recalled. Pakistan was playing a double game, as it had in the past. As had been the case in the midst of cooperation against the Soviets, the United States looked the other way. The other half of the American response involved arming the Northern Alliance, and the consequences of backing the two opposing factions became apparent almost immediately. As U.S.-backed Northern Alliance fighters toppled the Taliban stronghold of Kunduz, Musharraf made a frantic call to President Bush and asked for a favor, a break in the bombing and permission to land in Kunduz and airlift out Pakistanis. A series of flights collected men and ferried them into Pakistan, where they promptly disappeared. The operation was kept secret, and American officials lied to conceal it. Neither Pakistan nor any other country flew planes into Afghanistan to evacuate anybody, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld insisted. Those evacuated were, by most accounts, not innocent bystanders. Among them were numerous al-Qaeda loyalists. A CIA agent who worked with the Northern Alliance at the time told me flatly of the incident. It was a mistake. The extremists who escaped set up shop in Pakistan, where organized terrorist structures flourished in two safe havens. In Quetta, Mullah Omar built a new Taliban council, or Shura, and appointed commanders to lead an insurgency in Afghanistan's southern provinces. In the federally administered tribal agencies, Fatah, in northwest Pakistan, Jalaluddin Haqqani, no relation to Hussein, the ambassador, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, both former operatives used by the ISI and CIA against the Soviets, ran their own Taliban-allied movements. The ISI also continued to directly fund and arm the Taliban inside Afghanistan. Pakistan's military and intelligence leadership allowed the extremists to function openly, while brazenly lying to the Americans and denying anything was amiss. This was one of the great ironies of the war on terror. As the United States drew closer to Pakistan to fight the Taliban, it was, in effect, also ensuring the survival of the Taliban. Hussein Haqqani, who had become ambassador in the final year of the Bush administration, said Pakistani military and intelligence brass repeatedly asked him to lie about the support for terrorists. When Lashkar-e-Taiba, L.E.T., a group based out of Pakistan and heavily sponsored by the ISI, executed a series of bombings and shootings in Mumbai, India that killed 164 people, ISI Director Ahmed Shuja Pasha told Haqqani to inform the Americans that nobody in Pakistan had any knowledge of the attack, and that none of the perpetrators were Pakistani. I said, "But you know that's an outright lie. The reason why America and Pakistan have this huge trust deficit is because we tell them bold-faced lies," Haqqani said. "Diplomacy is never 100% truth, but it's never 100% lies either. I wanted it to be... He paused, a half-smile turning the edges of his lips. Truth well told. The Bush administration knew Pakistan was playing a double game, but as a general rule, publicly denied it. CIA Director Michael Hayden even said at the time that the United States had not had a better partner in the war on terrorism than the Pakistanis. Hayden, a retired four-star general, was a compact, energetic man with an affable manner. He spoke quickly, his eyebrows darting up and down over the ovals of his small, rimless glasses. When I pressed him on the Bush administration's rosy characterizations of the relationship with Pakistan, he was frank. If I said that about the Pakistanis, he told me, it was to balance that which then followed, which was, this is the ally from hell, because actually, they have made a deal with the devil. He had seen strong cooperation from some divisions of the ISI, but there were others, like the infamously pro-Al-Qaeda Directorate S, whose sole purpose in life was to actually sustain groups who we would identify as terrorist groups, Hayden said. General Pasha, likewise, had been duplicitous. Pasha declined to respond. I cannot tell half-truth, he wrote in an email, and I do not think I should tell the whole truth. General Pasha corresponded with courtly politeness and a lot of exclamation points, like a Victorian gentleman dictating to a millennial teen. Multiple senior Bush administration officials said they seldom, if ever, confronted Pakistan about the support for terrorists, for fear of jeopardizing the counterterrorism alliance. Hayden recalled only one such direct conversation late in the administration, in which Musharraf fobbed it off on retired ISI officers, you know, the ones who supported the Muj during the Soviet War. The U.S. had helped create Pakistan's state sponsorship of militant Islam in that era, and now it couldn't put the genie back in the bottle. If it wanted to, Hayden argued, that would take more than the narrow confines of intelligence and military cooperation. Look, I mean, the director of the CIA is not going to cause the government of Pakistan to change course based upon a conversation he has in either Washington or Islamabad, he said. That requires a whole government effort of long-term and really powerful sanctions that I saw no evidence that we were prepared to make. He was describing the urgent need for a larger diplomatic effort that would never take place. The result of Pakistan's double-dealing, and the United States' relative tolerance of it, was a slide into violent turmoil on the Afghan side of the border, with the Taliban steadily resurging over the course of the Bush administration. American and NATO operations offered periodic pushback, but the supply of fighters always replenished from the safe havens in Pakistan. Over the course of Bush's second term, the insurgency gained strength, staging devastating attacks, sometimes with the Pakistani military providing cover from across the border, firing on American and Afghan soldiers. The Taliban's gains allowed them to establish a parallel government in the country's south and then east, complete with governors and judges. By the beginning of the Obama administration, America was losing. Chapter 7. The Frat House. As Afghanistan and Pakistan unraveled, Richard Holbrooke was still chasing the role he felt he was born to play, Secretary of State. I first met him as he came close yet again in 2004, throwing his weight behind John Kerry's failed bid for the presidency. Holbrooke was a private citizen then, working as an investment banker again, but still a fixture at United Nations and charity functions. I was working with UNICEF in New York and several conflict zones. In Sudan, I began cranking out Wall Street Journal and International Herald Tribune columns about a gathering ethnic cleansing campaign there. For years, Holbrooke was religious about sending appraisals of my stories. Ronan, this is a splendid, vivid piece. You should try to get liftoff on this issue with State and the UN. I'll send it around. Or, just as often, next time put a bit more emphasis on solutions so it comes across as more than an anti-UN rant. He took correspondence seriously. In that 2010 State Department speech marking the release of the Vietnam documents, he lamented that, in all likelihood, the volumes being released now will never be matched again, with emails and video teleconferences. Documentation just isn't what it used to be. He was, by the time I knew him, a practitioner of dying arts. That I was far too young for any of it, a teenager when I interned for him during his time advising the Kerry campaign, never seemed to faze him. It made sense. he himself had perfected the art of being too young and outspoken for his station. He let me in, and I was green enough to think nothing of it. Holbrook was on the outside then, a role that would become familiar in the following years. So it was on January 19, 2009, the night before President Barack Obama's inauguration and the prime moment for the pre-inaugural parties that send D.C. elites into a frenzy of invitation chasing every 4 years. One such party, hosted by Republican socialite Buffy Kaffritz and her husband Bill, had been a venue for bipartisan schmoozing since the 1980s. Most years, it drew 250 or 300 guests. This year, more than 500 packed the ballroom of the Fairfax at Embassy Row, humming with excitement. Movie star jostled politician jostled reporter. They huddled, cocktails in hand, necks craning for marquee names from the new administration. Change was in the air, and everyone wanted to be a part of it. You can feel the energy of a crowd of political operators change when someone worth currying favor with walks in. When Bill and Hillary Clinton arrived that night, she defeated on the campaign trail but lifted by her nomination as Barack Obama's new Secretary of State, the dimly lit ballroom practically tilted. Hillary Clinton smiled a wide, frozen smile and nodded her way through the crush. Huma Abedin, Clinton's longtime body woman, trailed behind, thumbs pounding on her BlackBerry. Richard Holbrook had been studying the crowd with undisguised intensity, eyes darting across the sea of faces as he half paid attention to our conversation. He was standing at the outskirts of the ballroom in an ill-fitting charcoal suit and a purple and white tie. At 67, he was overweight and graying, a universe and a generation apart from the lanky Foreign Service officer smiling from behind horn-rimmed glasses in photos from the Mekong Delta. But the smirk and the piercing eyes were the same. We caught up briefly, but Holbrook's focus never left the crowd. He was on. This was work. When Clinton entered the scene, he departed with a clipped, "We'll talk later," and strode over to her, fast enough to attract a few sideways glances. He and Clinton had been close since her husband's presidency, when Holbrook was at times a mentor during her early years on the international stage. During the coming administration, she would prove to be his staunchest defender. But he never seemed on sure footing in those years, even with her. Every moment of precious face time counted. One could not be with him for even the briefest period without knowing how badly he wanted to succeed, the war reporter David Halberstam wrote after becoming close with Holbrook in Vietnam. That night at the Fairfax was Exhibit A. In backing Hillary Clinton, Holbrook had, once again, bet on the wrong horse. But he was scrappy as ever, and the moment Clinton lost the 2008 primary, he began a campaign to break into an Obama administration, to which he was very much an outsider. He worked the phones, calling anyone he could think of until, finally, friends told him to rein it in. For a time, he held a record for having appeared more often than anyone else on the PBS interview show hosted by Charlie Rose. In an August 2008 appearance, he tried frantically to pivot toward Obama. I supported Senator Clinton based on an old and close personal relationship and long-standing commitments, but I've read Senator Obama's positions extremely carefully, and there was no major position he took which I would disagree on. He also brought together a group of 13 foreign policy people, and a lot of people noted that your name, your presence, was not there, Rose fired back. Holbrook never had much of a poker face and looked for a moment almost despairing. And they are disappointed, frankly, Rose went on, because they think you are one of the principal spokespeople for foreign policy on the Democratic side of the aisle, because of your wide experience and your... My frequent appearances on your program, he laughed a little too hard. Your frequent appearances on this program. Why weren't you there? I think I was doing a program with you. Be candid with me. Tell me why you weren't there, and what was the story? Holbrook glanced to the side and then said, in a tone that suggested he'd rather douse himself in gasoline and self-immolate on that oak table than admit what he said next, I wasn't there because I wasn't invited. To which he added quickly, I don't have any problem. They can have anyone they want at a meeting. Actually, I was out of the city on that day and I couldn't have gone anyway. Rose asked if he'd spoken to Obama, and Holbrook instead responded with a list of advisors he had ties to. We have all worked together. Susan Rice, Tony Blinken for Biden, Greg Craig. I worked closely with all of Senator Obama's current team. I know them well. But the truth was, Richard Holbrook had precious little currency with Obama's team. He had indeed worked with Susan Rice during the Clinton administration. To say they didn't get along would be putting it mildly. During one meeting, the feud got so bad that she flipped him the bird in front of a room full of staffers. Holbrooke allies, in turn, called her a pipsqueak with a chip on her shoulder in the press. Officials who worked with both said she felt Holbrooke had trampled over her. "He tried to trample over me," she clarified. "I don't think he succeeded." Holbrooke's relationship with Blinken, likewise, wasn't enough to prevent his boss, Vice President Joe Biden, from telling Obama, "He's the most egotistical bastard I've ever met." Though Biden did admit Holbrooke was maybe the right guy to tackle the war in Afghanistan. And Greg Craig, whom Holbrooke also listed, would soon fall out of favor with the Obama camp. To many Obama loyalists, Holbrooke was the enemy, part of the old guard of foreign policy elites that had accreted around the Clintons and dismissed Obama and his inner circle as upstarts. Holbrooke had avoided publicly criticizing the young senator from Illinois, but he had also leaned into his role as a Hillary loyalist, calling other foreign policy experts and signaling that support for Obama might mean throwing away job opportunities in a Clinton presidency and, presumably, a Holbrooke State Department. Like much of the Democratic foreign policy establishment, he also wore the scarlet letter of his initial support for the war in Iraq. Later, he wrote and spoke about the disastrous repercussions of that invasion, including the neglect of Afghanistan. But in the eyes of many in the new administration, he remained exactly what Obama had run against. There was also a divide of culture. Obama had run on excitement and change, not history or experience. He would later describe himself as probably the first president who was young enough that the Vietnam War wasn't at the core of my development. When the United States finally pulled out of Vietnam in 1975, he was just 13. So I grew up with none of the baggage that arose out of the dispute of the Vietnam War. With a few notable exceptions, he surrounded himself with young men of the same generational outlook. Perhaps the most sustained and influential voice on foreign policy in the White House, Ben Rhodes, was given his bespoke role, Deputy National Security Advisor for Communications, at 31. Staffers spent years swatting away a recurring comparison, White House as frat house. In this White House, representatives of the dusty establishment were out of vogue. After a bruising race, Clinton loyalists were even less welcome, especially those with outsized personalities. I think his whirlwind of activity, did cause some raised eyebrows in the White House, Hillary Clinton said of Holbrooke. They thought he was going outside the lines of the orderly policy process, the no-drama White House they were trying to run, and it was very painful for me. 2 days after the election, Richard Holbrooke arrived in Chicago to interview with the president-elect. The meeting, which lasted 30 minutes, was an immediate disaster. According to friends Holbrooke called afterward, Obama greeted him as Dick, to which Holbrooke corrected him, saying that his wife, the writer Kati Marton, preferred that he be addressed as Richard. That's a joke, right? Les Gelb, Holbrooke's longtime friend who had involved him in the Pentagon Papers years earlier, recalled telling Holbrooke. You didn't really say that, did you? It wasn't. He did. Obama was annoyed and later told several people so. For some reason, President Obama thought he, that is Holbrooke, had been treating him with some condescension, Henry Kissinger said. I do not know whether that's true, but anyway, certainly Holbrooke had a lot more experience than the new people coming in. In a sense, these were all characterizations of something simple. This was a job interview, like any other, and Obama just didn't like the guy. Amid the sweaty schmoozing at the Fairfax on Inauguration Eve, Holbrooke was laser-focused. Hillary Clinton becoming Secretary of State was bittersweet, but also a reprieve. He would play a role in the administration. I watched as he and Clinton talked. He whispered in her ear. The two of them laughed. He made sure the assembled crowd saw it. Clinton was at her most ebullient. The Obamas weren't coming, and she was the focus of every glance and whisper. She and I had attended the same law school where several antediluvian professors spanned both of our enrollments. We'd met a number of times over the years, and she had always been kinder than she needed to be. Clinton had a preternatural knack for social recall, or at least artfully covering for memories she lacked. She professed to have read some of my foreign policy columns and asked what I was doing next. I said I was deciding whether to go back to the law firm where I'd been a summer associate. She looked at me hard and said, talk to Holbrook. She and Holbrook had already begun crafting a new role for him, one she would later describe as, by many metrics, the most difficult in the administration. Ever since my experience in Paris in 1968 as a junior member of the Vietnam negotiating team under Averill Harriman and Cyrus Vance, Holbrook once wrote, I had wanted to test myself against the most difficult negotiations in the world. He would get his wish. Chapter 8. Mission Impossible. When Holbrook's assignment first leaked, the role was framed as a special envoy for India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. This was not sloppy reporting. Though his mandate was ultimately downsized to include only the latter two countries, Holbrook had initially envisioned sweeping region-wide negotiations. Afghanistan's future cannot be secured by a counterinsurgency effort alone, he wrote in 2008. It will also require regional agreements that give Afghanistan's neighbors a stake in the settlement. That includes Iran, as well as China, India, and Russia. But the most important neighbor is, of course, Pakistan, which can destabilize Afghanistan at will, and has. In Bosnia, Holbrook had juggled similarly fractious parties. Not only Bosnian Muslims, Croats, and Serbs, but also Russia, the European allies, and organizations like the UN and NATO. Here, he again saw a need for a grand strategic approach. This ambitious plan for another Mission Impossible-style political settlement built on old-school diplomacy quickly collided with the realities of the new administration. 2 days after the parties on Inauguration Eve, Holbrook stood in front of a crowd of current and former diplomats in the Benjamin Franklin State Dining Room, the grandest ceremonial chamber on the State Department's 8th floor. The room was renovated in the 1980s in a classical style meant to evoke the great reception halls of continental Europe. Ornate Corinthian pillars, clad in red plaster and painted with faux marble veins, lined the walls. Portuguese cut-glass chandeliers hung around a ceiling molding of the Great Seal of the United States. A bald eagle, one set of talons grasping a bundle of arrows, the other an olive branch. Holbrook was flanked by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on his right, and Joe Biden and the administration's newly appointed Middle East peace envoy, George Mitchell, on his left. It's an extraordinarily moving thing for me to return to this building again, having entered it so many years ago as a junior Foreign Service officer, he began. In Afghanistan, he described a war gone wrong. In Pakistan, a challenge infinitely complex. He thanked the president for paying tribute to diplomats on his second day in office. And Obama, in turn, stressed his commitment to the importance of diplomacy and his recognition that America's strength comes not just from the might of our arms. Those convictions were tested during his 8 years in office. Holbrook looked out at his wife, Kati, his sons David and Anthony, and colleagues he'd known across decades. He seemed emotional, his voice wavering. I see my former roommate in Saigon, John Negroponte, here, he said. We remember those days well, and I hope we will produce a better outcome this time. The audience laughed. Obama was expressionless. While other regional initiatives being announced by the new administration were headed by envoys, Holbrook, in what was to be one of many annoyances for the White House, insisted that he be given a sui generis title, Special Representative. It was, in his view, a more concrete managerial term than envoy, a way to signal that he was building up a sizable operational team. In 1970, young Holbrook had written an article in Foreign Policy, the upstart publication at which he would later become editor, decrying the sclerotic, siloed bureaucracy of the State Department. Returning decades later, he decided to shake things up. He began assembling a crack team with officials detailed from across the government. There were representatives from USAID and the Department of Agriculture, the Treasury and the Department of Justice, the Pentagon and the CIA and the FBI. Then there were the outsiders, counterculture thinkers drawn from civil society, business, and academia. Vali Nasser, the Iranian-American scholar of Middle East studies, had received a midnight text in December. It was characteristically theatrical. If you work for anyone else, I will break your knees. And then, anticipating Nasser's preference for an Iran-focused job, this matters more. This is what the president is focused on. This is where you want to be. Barnett Rubin, a New York University professor and authority on Afghan history and culture, got a call as well. Rina Amiri, an Afghan activist who had worked with the UN and Open Society Institute, recognized Hallberg on a Delta shuttle from D.C. to New York and began pressing him about the upcoming Afghan elections. Hallberg was impressed and told her he was assembling a team. "I know," she said, "but I'm here to lobby you." "I'm very efficient," he said. "I just turned your lobbying into a job interview." My own interview was, likewise, distinctive. "What should we be doing differently?" Hallberg shouted over the hiss of the shower he was taking in the middle of that job interview. From the next room over, I laughed. I couldn't help it. It was the culmination of a sprawling, hours-long meeting, which had ranged from his office to the Secretary of State's to his townhouse in Georgetown. I had followed up on Clinton's advice at the pre-inaugural party at the Fairfax and begun talking to Hallberg and his chief of staff, Rosemary Pauley. A little over a month later, in March 2009, I arrived at the State Department to meet with him in person. He barreled out of his office, lobbing policy questions at me. How would I reinvigorate trade in Central Asia? How would I maximize the impact of assistance to the Pakistanis? Never mind that I was a wet-behind-the-ears lawyer with a modest foreign policy background in Africa, not Afghanistan. I'd worked with local non-governmental groups in the developing world, and Hallberg wanted to ramp up the United States' emphasis on those groups, a change of culture in a war zone where most of the implementation happened through powerful American contractors. He wanted non-traditional answers, unencumbered by government experience. The State Department, in D.C.'s Foggy Bottom neighborhood, is an imposing slab of stripped classical architecture, clad in limestone and built in portions in the 1930s and 1950s. The earliest part of the complex was intended for the growing War Department after World War I, though with the construction of the more ambitious Pentagon, it never actually became the military's headquarters. The looming rear entrance to the building is still known as the War Department, a flourish of irony for the seat of American peacemaking. The department is a literal hierarchy, with opulent ceremonial rooms for receiving foreign dignitaries on the 8th floor, the secretary's office on the 7th, and offices of roughly descending importance on the floors beneath. During Hallberg's prodigious turn as assistant secretary in his mid-30s, he had occupied an office complex on the 6th floor. Now he'd been relegated to the 1st, next to the cafeteria, where Robin Rafel was later deposited, and across the hall from the department newsstand, where Hallberg would load up on junk food between meetings. Our walk and talk started in his office and moved into the hallway, then up to the 7th floor and the Secretary of State's ornate wood-paneled office. He moved briskly through the entire conversation, only occasionally making eye contact, aides hurrying after him and handing him papers. He paused my answers frequently to take calls on his BlackBerry. This was not real-life government, where meetings are seated and stayed. This was government as dramatized by Aaron Sorkin. Hallberg and I, and a veteran CIA officer Hallberg was also lobbying to join his team, Frank Archibald, met with Clinton briefly in the antechamber outside her office. He outlined a dazzling vision for the roles we'd play. Repackaged and artfully marketed by Hallberg, every underling was a one-person revolution. Archibald was going to single-handedly heal suspicions between state and the CIA. I was going to realign American assistance to NGOs. Amiri, I heard him say on numerous occasions, had written the Afghan Constitution. As he worked up a particular lather about this at one function, she leaned in and whispered in my ear, "I did not write the Afghan Constitution." None of us had any business interviewing with the Secretary of State for our jobs, but many of us did through dint of Hallberg's willpower. Hallberg had leaned on the patronage of great men himself, from Scotty Reston at the Times to Dean Rusk and Averill Harriman. He wanted to be the man that people would say was that kind of man. And he was. After meeting with the secretary, we had returned to Hallberg's office suite on the 1st floor where he'd picked up his luggage. He had just returned from a trip and had to go home to change before an afternoon meeting at the White House. He passed me a suitcase and out we went to hail a cab, not interrupting the flow of questions. Would I favor more overt United States branding on USAID assistance in the region? How would I enlist local watchdog groups in ensuring electoral transparency? I had just recovered from several years in a wheelchair, the result of a bone marrow infection left untreated while working in Sudan. Hallberg was aware of this, but characteristically oblivious to it in the moment. I hobbled after him with his luggage. When we arrived at his Georgetown townhouse, he headed upstairs, not asking, naturally, just carrying on with the conversation. He left the bathroom door ajar and peed. "What about negotiations with the Taliban?" he asked demurely. "Really?" I said. "What?" he replied innocently from behind the bathroom door, as if this were the most normal thing in the world. And for him, it was. Virtually everyone seemed to have a story about Holbrook meetings in bathrooms. He poked his head out, unbuttoning his shirt. "I'm gonna hop in the shower." I stood outside the door. The job interview continued. Many Holbrook wooed hesitated. Rina Amiri, worried about her outspoken views on human rights being muted, held out for a month. Barnett Rubin made it a condition that he be allowed to keep his academic perch at NYU part-time. I myself wasn't convinced. The State Department wasn't a glamorous career move. "I would go to Davis Polk," one law school classmate wrote to me, referring to the law firm where I had a job offer. "What is the point of these technocratic positions? Do you really want to spend 40 years trying to move your way up? If you work really hard, you might end up where Holbrook is himself, which is a whole lot of nowhere, really. Fuck that." But Holbrook brought to every job he ever held a visionary quality that transcended practical considerations. He talked openly about changing the world. "If Richard calls you and asks you for something, just say yes," Henry Kissinger said. "If you say no, you'll eventually get to yes, but the journey will be very painful." We all said yes. By the summer, Holbrook had assembled his Ocean's 11 heist team, about 30 of us from different disciplines and agencies, with and without government experience. In the Pakistani press, the colorful additions to the team were watched closely and generally celebrated. Others took a dimmer view. "He got this strange band of characters around him." "Don't attribute that to me," a senior military leader told me. His efforts to bring into the State Department representatives from all of the agencies that had a kind of stake or contribution to our efforts, I thought was absolutely brilliant, Hillary Clinton said, and everybody else was fighting tooth and nail. It was only later, when I worked in the wider State Department bureaucracy as Clinton's director of global youth issues during the Arab Spring, that I realized how singular life was in the office of the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, quickly acronymed, like all things in government, to SRAP. The drab, low-ceilinged office space next to the cafeteria was about as far from the colorful open workspaces of Silicon Valley as you could imagine, but it had the feeling of a startup. The office was soon graced with cameos from eclectic and unexpected faces. Holbrook hosted a procession of journalists, to whom he remained as close as he had in previous jobs. Prominent lawmakers visited. He met with Angelina Jolie about refugees and Natalie Portman about microfinance. Holbrook knew what he was doing was counterculture, and he believed it to be historic. There were reminders of his view of our place in history everywhere. Even his office was a shrine to wars that came before. In framed pictures on the walls, there he was, smiling in the Mekong Delta. There he was with Bill Clinton in East Timor, or in Sarajevo, flanked by armed guards. "Are you keeping a journal?" he'd asked me. "One day, you'll write about this." Clinton had told Holbrook he would be the direct civilian counterpart to General David Petraeus, who was then the commander of U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, the powerful Pentagon division responsible for Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. "He has more airplanes than I have telephones," Holbrook later grumbled. Petraeus was a small man with a wiry physique honed through a daily pre-dawn workout regimen that had become catnip for profile writers. 5 miles of running, followed by 20 chin-ups, a torturous modification involving a full leg raise until his shoelaces touched the bar, and then 100 push-ups. At a 2016 meeting of the shadowy Bilderberg Group in Dresden, Petraeus, by then in his 60s, was accosted by 20-something-year-old reporters shouting questions. He sprinted away. They tried and failed to catch him. He had once taken an M16 shot to the chest during a live-fire training exercise and lived to tell the tale. Legend had it that he ate one meal a day and never slept more than 4 hours. I once had the misfortune to stand in line at a buffet next to him. His eyes flicked down to my plate of mac and cheese. "I'm going for a run later," I offered defensively. He clapped a hand on my shoulder. "Really? Think you can keep up?" I have never gone for a run in my life. Petraeus, like Holbrook, was a larger-than-life operator who knew how to build a public narrative and use it to his advantage. He, too, had the ear of every reporter in Washington, a direct line to the op-ed pages, and a tendency to surround himself with experts who could help propagate his message outside of the government. He was, enraptured profiles noted, a scholar general, and this was true. He had been an ace student at West Point before receiving a doctorate from Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His doctoral dissertation was titled The American Military and the Lessons of Vietnam, a study of military influence and the use of force in the post-Vietnam era. Holbrooke and Petraeus both interrogated America's misadventures in Vietnam, but they came up with diametrically opposed answers. Holbrooke believed counterinsurgency doctrine, or COIN as it came to be known, was a recipe for quagmire, breeding dependency in local populations. Petraeus believed in the doctrine and built a career championing its revival. In Iraq, he relied on a sweeping COIN strategy. Broadly speaking, that meant a large deployment of troops integrated within Iraqi society over a long period of time, securing communities while getting the bad guys. Petraeus had emerged from that conflict a hero. Critics argued that he benefited from events outside his control, like al-Qaeda leader Muqtada al-Sadr declaring a unilateral ceasefire. Others contended that his accomplishments fell apart after his departure, or that they were exaggerated to begin with. That included then-Senator Hillary Clinton, who in a 2007 congressional hearing accused Petraeus of presenting an overly optimistic assessment of the Iraq troop surge, at a time when she was seeking to create distance from her Iraq vote. "I think the reports that you provide to us really require the willing suspension of disbelief," she said. But in Petraeus's view, COIN had worked in Iraq, and for his many ardent supporters in the Pentagon, it became gospel. In Afghanistan, he intended to put COIN to the test a second time. Shortly after Hillary Clinton accepted Obama's job offer, she, Petraeus, and Holbrooke sat around the fireplace at her Georgian-style mansion near D.C.'s Embassy Row and shared a bottle of wine. "I worked really hard to make sure Richard had relationships with the generals," Clinton said. "I invited him and Dave Petraeus, who hadn't met each other, to come to my house and to talk about what each of them thought needed to be done." She knew Petraeus, who had just become commander of CENTCOM, would play a defining role in some of her greatest international challenges. That night at Clinton's home marked the first of a series of dinners and drinks between the two men, and the partnership was often characterized as a strong one in the press. "Richard did share Petraeus's interest in an aggressive counterinsurgency strategy," Clinton recalled, "but focused on increasing the credibility of the government in Kabul and trying to weaken the appeal of the Taliban. Richard wasn't sure that adding more troops would assist that. He thought it would maybe undermine goodwill." The truth was, Petraeus and Holbrooke were wary of each other. Organized, tightly controlled Petraeus, though subsequent years of scandal would suggest not so tightly controlled in some areas, was often uncomfortable with Holbrooke's freewheeling improvisation. New York Times reporter Mark Landler later recalled Petraeus arriving for a meeting as he interviewed Holbrooke, and Petraeus's dismay both at Holbrooke's impromptu suggestion that Landler stay on with the two of them, and at Holbrooke's shoeless feet propped on a coffee table. "Richard, why aren't you wearing shoes?" Petraeus asked, horrified. Holbrooke said he was more comfortable that way. "I first met Petraeus at the Kabul headquarters of ISAF, the NATO mission in Afghanistan. I'd presented a PowerPoint..." The military loves PowerPoints, on civil society in Afghanistan, and afterwards Holbrooke, in his typical manner of elevating subordinates, introduced me to the general. "So, you're working for my diplomatic wingman," Petraeus said, rising from his seat to shake my hand. Petraeus called Holbrooke his wingman a lot, in private and in the press. Holbrooke hated it. He didn't particularly relish being anyone's wingman. And the power imbalance, and what Holbrooke took to be Petraeus's ribbing about it, struck a deeper nerve, running against the grain of Holbrooke's belief that military power should be used to support diplomatic goals. "His job should be to drop the bombs when I tell him to," Holbrooke told our team testily. Petraeus later told me he intended wingman to be a show of respect, but he admitted that the relationship was fraught. "He was a difficult partner at various times. I think he had ADD and some other things. Very difficult for him to stay focused," he recalled. "Richard came in thinking, I am Richard Holbrooke, and the administration came in thinking, I am Barack Obama. Seriously bright people, but they were supposedly going to be able to do something that nobody else could do." As the new administration assembled, Obama ordered a sweeping review of America's role in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The process was so torturous that the journalist Bob Woodward managed to spin an entire book out of disgruntled accounts of it. For 10 meetings spanning more than 25 hours, the president heard arguments and proposals. Countless more meetings were conducted by lower-ranking officials. The fundamental question, how many troops to deploy and when? The military had already requested a surge of 30,000 troops when Obama began his term, and during the review, military leaders fought tooth and nail for a fully resourced counterinsurgency, with as many troops as possible, as fast as possible, to remain as long as possible. We cannot achieve our objectives without more troops, Petraeus argued. After the very first National Security Council meeting on the subject, he said he was going to move forward on the pending troop surge. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel had to rein him in. Hold on, he said, according to leaked accounts. General, I appreciate you're doing your job, but I didn't hear the President of the United States give that order. Holbrook was nominally the co-chair of the review process, along with retired CIA veteran Bruce Rydell and, according to Rydell, Petraeus as an unacknowledged third co-chair. But Holbrook was sidelined by Rydell, who had greater access to the president, by a series of generals, and by the White House itself. The review threw into sharp relief the generational and cultural chasm between Holbrook and Obama. In a February 2009 National Security Council meeting, Holbrook compared the deliberations to those Lyndon Johnson conducted with his advisors during Vietnam. History should not be forgotten, he said. The room fell silent. Obama muttered, "Ghosts." When Holbrook brought up Vietnam again several months later, the president was less demure. "Richard," he snapped, cutting him off, "do people really talk like that?" Holbrook had begun taping audio diaries of his experiences, with an eye toward history and a memoir. "In some of the early NSC meetings with the president, I referred to Vietnam and was told by Hillary that the president did not want any references to Vietnam," he said in one, his voice sounding tired on the scratchy tape. "I was very struck by this since I thought there were obviously relevant issues." "He was incredibly unhappy with the way he was personally treated," Hillary Clinton reflected. "I was too, because I thought a lot of what he was offering had real merit and it didn't somehow fit into the worldview that the White House had." Holbrook had allowed himself to be categorized not as someone to be heard, but as someone to be tolerated. But the more meaningful divide was with the military. Holbrook was no dove. He had supported the invasion in Iraq, and at the outset of the review, he endorsed an initial deployment of troops in advance of the Afghan elections as a stopgap. But he felt military engagement should be organized around the goal of achieving a political settlement. He was alarmed by the force of persuasion the military voices at the NSC table commanded, sometimes crowding out non-military solutions. "I told David Axelrod that we had been dominated much too long by pure milfink," he said in another tape. "Military thinking and military domination. And while I had great respect for the military, and Petraeus was brilliant, I liked them as individuals and they were great Americans, they should not dictate political strategy, which is what's happening now." After one meeting, he emerged exhausted and told Vali Nasr something absurd. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates had bigger folders. His maps and charts were more colorful. The SRAP team had cranked out voluminous policy papers, but they were going unread by many of the president's advisors. "Who can make graphics?" he asked in one meeting. Everyone looked at me. "Ageism," I muttered, and went to work making Technicolor PowerPoints out of his policy proposals, which he dictated in minute detail. Often they focused on political and diplomatic solutions he felt were being given short shrift by the White House. A series of concentric circles showed the complex landscape of global players he felt the United States needed to do more to engage, from international donors to NATO states to rising powers like India and China. Triangles linked by arrows illustrated trilateral relations between Pakistan, India, and the U.S., A flowchart titled "Changing Pakistan's Behavior Toward the Taliban" offered a storybook simplification of his plan for the most difficult bilateral relationship in the world. 1. Focus on entire country with new U.S.-led international assistance and new commitments campaign. 2. Which builds pro-U.S. sentiment. 3. Which helps turn the Pakistani government and Pakistani military toward our position. 4. which gets Pakistan's military to take more action against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The graphics did little to move the needle. Advocates for a full troop surge were more numerous and had better access than voices of caution. Rydell rode on Air Force One with the president and briefed him without others present. Secretary of Defense Bob Gates supported his generals and their lobbying for a robust troop surge. Retired General Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor, did as well. So did his deputy in charge of Afghanistan, retired Lieutenant General Doug Lute. Hillary Clinton, despite her advocacy for Holbrooke, was fundamentally a hawk. "There's plenty of blame," Ben Rhodes, the deputy National Security Advisor, later recalled. "Holbrooke's biggest defender was Hillary, and yet she constantly sided with the generals in the policy discussions. I was convinced that Richard was right about the need for both a major diplomatic campaign and a civilian surge," Clinton said. "I did disagree with him that additional troops weren't needed to make that work, because I thought, given how the Bush administration had kind of lost interest in Afghanistan because of their hyper-concern about Iraq, that the Taliban was really on the upsurge and that there had to be some demonstration that we'd be willing to push back on them." Holbrooke had to hold his tongue, but he knew force alone couldn't solve the crisis in Afghanistan. "My position was very precise," he said over a meal with Bob Woodward, who recorded the conversation. "I will support you in any position you take, because you're my boss, but you need to know my actual views. I have serious concerns about the fact that our troops are going to be spread too thin, and I'm most concerned we're going to get into a mission resource mismatch. A lot of people thought I was overly influenced by Vietnam. It didn't matter to me. At least I had some experience there." "I always had such regret about the Holbrooke thing," Rhodes said. "It went wrong, and it feels very unnecessary when I look back. It was," he reflected, "like Holbrooke was in a game of musical chairs, and he was the guy without a chair to sit in." One of the Kafkaesque qualities of the period was the profusion of seemingly duplicative reviews. Not just the White House's process led by Rydell, but prior assessments by Petraeus and one by Stanley McChrystal, the new general in charge of Afghanistan. Just before McChrystal released his recommendations, Holbrooke told our team exactly how the process would play out. There would be three choices. A high-risk option, he said, gesturing above his eyeline. That is what they like to call it, which will call for maybe very few troops. Low troops, high risk. Then there will be a low-risk option, he said, moving his hand down, which will ask for double the number they are actually looking for. In the middle will be what they want. Holbrooke had seen this movie before. The first recommendation of the final Rydell report was for a fully resourced counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. After months of dithering, the president chose COIN and a deployment of 30,000 additional troops. Obama announced the surge with an expiration date. 2 years later, in mid-2011, withdrawals would begin. Conspicuously absent from either the Rydell report or the president's announcement was any commitment to negotiation, either with Pakistan over the terrorist safe havens or with the Taliban in Afghanistan. There was no discussion at all of diplomacy and a political settlement, Vali Nasser recalled. Holbrooke wanted the president to consider this option, but the White House was not buying it. The military wanted to stay in charge, and going against the military would make the president look weak. Chapter 9. Walking on Glass. It was Ramadan in 2010, and Umar Chima, a Pakistani journalist, woke up in the middle of the night to spend time with friends while they waited for suhoor, the pre-dawn meal with which observant Muslims break fast. They hung out at Dominico Park, which in the day overlooks spectacular views of Islamabad, and at night turns into a warren of romantic courtyards and gardens, bathed in golden light. The group left at around 2:30 a.m., crowding into Chima's car for a ride to their respective homes. He had dropped off the last of his friends and was on his way home when he noticed two cars had been following him. One, a white Toyota Corolla, fell in line behind him. Another, a black Jeep, pulled in front of him. As he stopped, three men in police uniform jumped out of the Jeep. They said, strangely, that he'd run over a man and fled the scene. Chima, who wrote for Pakistan's The News and had won the Daniel Pearl Fellowship for Foreign Journalists and worked for The New York Times, had never been involved in a crime in his life. He had, however, written a series of hard-hitting articles about the powers that be, He exposed army controversies, including allegations that court-martialed officers were being denied fair trials. He dug into evidence that Pakistani intelligence was behind a series of disappearances of civilians. He reported that intelligence agents were letting suspects in a major terrorist attack go. He told the officers there'd been a mix-up, but let them lead him into their car. That's when they blindfolded him and took away his phone. When they pulled off his blindfold, Chima was seated in a bare room with peeling green cement walls. It was lit by a single exposed light bulb. A fan turned slowly in a corner. When he asked where he was, his captors told him to shut up. In the dim light, he could see three of them, their faces covered with children's party masks. They tore off Chima's clothes, threw him to the floor, and beat him with wooden rods. They shaved his head and eyebrows and took pictures of him cowering. They didn't mince words about their motivations. "You're here because of the stories," said one. "This will teach you to be obedient." I had been reporting about the missing persons, so that gave me the idea of the horrifying stories the families had been through, he told me. I thought of my son. He was 2 years old. I realized if I didn't make it back, my son would grow up alone. Chima steeled himself against the pain. I told myself, I am being punished for doing something good, for being truthful. Chima's captors beat him on and off for nearly 7 hours, then dumped him, naked and bleeding, by the side of the road outside Islamabad. His car had been left there. They gave him 100 rupees to cover tolls back into the city. The operation was a well-oiled machine of intimidation. Chima had the distinct sense that they'd done it before. His case was unusual solely in that the intimidation didn't work. He immediately went public. There was little question in Chima's mind who was behind the attack. His night from hell was preceded by a series of meetings with the ISI, which had gotten in touch before and after his stories with ominous advice. The agency had a history of dealing with disobedient people, agents would remind him. Being a journalist in Pakistan can be a death wish. Reporters there are routinely beaten, and sometimes worse. The year after Umar Chima's beating, Syed Salim Shahzad, who had been reporting on links between the ISI and Islamist militant groups, was beaten to death. His corpse was found floating in a canal outside of Islamabad. The CIA later intercepted telephone calls that suggested the killing was directly ordered by the ISI, likely by General Pasha himself. Since 1992, the Committee to Protect Journalists has documented 60 murders of reporters with motives related to their work in Pakistan. Stories about human rights, the war in Afghanistan, and corruption are all dangerous, but the single most deadly beat, comprising 67% of deaths, is politics, often stories about the ISI or the military. Pakistan was a paradox in this respect. The country had a sophisticated 24-hour TV news cycle. It had spirited columnists and commentators. But the military and ISI still ruled with an iron fist. Countless reporters were even on intelligence payroll, paid to write favorable stories and as insurance that they wouldn't write harsh ones. The plight of the journalists, like the disappearances and extrajudicial killings they sometimes died covering, underscored the waning space for conversation in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. At the State Department, I found that raising the disappearing reporters and verboten stories was an uphill battle. It was another fight not worth picking at the height of counterterrorism cooperation. Such moral compromise was a familiar, some would say inevitable, feature of national security-sensitive relationships. But the growing list of subjects that the United States appeared to be powerless to raise was alarming. This was the challenge Richard Holbrooke faced when he stepped into the job, a relationship in which no one talked about anything outside of tactics. Chima related his experience to several State Department officials who were sympathetic, but not interested. There was literally no word about these human rights violations unless there are tensions going on between the ISI and CIA, he told me. Washington has its own interests. Why would they bother if there is any problem, as long as the ISI is cooperating with them? The human rights issues threw the power imbalances of the American government into sharp relief. The bilateral relationship with Pakistan was almost entirely run between intelligence agencies and militaries, but neither of those entities felt it was within their mandate to raise human rights. "It never entered into my conversations with the Pakistanis," General Hayden said of the murders and disappearances. "When I went to Islamabad, I had very specific asks. I was going for a purpose. We need to go to do this. I need your help to do this. Here's what we're going to offer. Can I count on your assistance here? Hayden sighed. We already know that the ISI were apparently killing journalists, all right? That may affect my overall view of ISI, but it doesn't affect my working with ISI to try and capture an Al-Qaeda operative in Wana or Mir Ali. This was a common sentiment among intelligence and military leaders overseeing the Pakistan relationship. These kinds of broader conversations were, they felt, someone else's problem. But because the power within the U.S. policy process was so skewed away from civilian leadership, it was hard to know who could meaningfully raise such issues. Hayden's successor at the CIA, Leon Panetta, found his attempts to confront these issues frustrating. Panetta was a former politician and veteran of the executive branch, but an outsider to the intelligence community when President Obama appointed him to the agency job. He was heavy-set and bespectacled, with an avuncular manner and an easy laugh. He said he was conscious of the legal requirement to stop assistance to military units engaging in human rights abuses, the so-called Leahy Law. When we found out that they were obviously implementing extrajudicial approaches, he said, chuckling at the turn of phrase, it raised some real concerns. So the approach that we decided on was to, rather than slam them down, try to see if there were ways to improve their own process. The Pakistanis tended to be less than receptive. They kind of looked at me with a whimsical look as if to say, you know, you guys don't get it. More laughter. You got all these nice laws and rules, but the fact is these people are killers. They've killed people. They've killed us, and our history is one of basically dealing with these people on the same basis. At the same time, you say, well, look, you want F-16s? You want the latest equipment? Do you want to be able to get what we can provide? Then this is something you're going to have to pay attention to. They were kind of looking at you out of the side of their eye, saying, you know, we'll play along with this joke, but let's not forget, it's a joke. He laughed again. I have never seen anyone laugh so much during a conversation about extrajudicial killings. The region's counterterrorism imperatives and Pakistan's nuclear capacity conspired to strip the United States of its power. No matter how much you would bitch about what they were doing and the games they were playing and the difficulty in the relationship, the bottom line was you were dealing with a nuclear-powered country, Panetta recalled. As a result of that, there was always the danger that if you got on their wrong side, either because of their own carelessness or just the way they operated, that at some point a terrorist group would get their hands on one of these weapons, he added. You were always walking on glass when you were dealing with the Pakistanis. And so the dynamics of the relationship remained unaltered. Bald-faced lies were its bedrock, and within the confines of counterterrorism cooperation, those lies were tolerated or even encouraged. The entire strategy of drone strikes used to take out Al-Qaeda leadership was premised on a mutual understanding that the Pakistanis would lie to their people out of political necessity. The culture of deception in the relationship sometimes felt impossible to roll back. It was a hard place to get your head around, Ambassador Ann Patterson later told me in her subdued southern drawl. It was so weird. It was just downright non-linear. The typical rhythm of the relationship went something like this. The ISI would plant negative items about the U.S. in the Pakistani media, including conspiracy theories about Indian operatives in Congress or the White House. The stories whipped up a frenzy of anti-American sentiment. Then the ISI would come back to the Americans and insist that public opinion prevented them from changing their approach to terrorist safe havens or to supporting Islamist militias. Which is actually true, Patterson reflected, but it's public opinion that they themselves have generated. Patterson had a frank, straightforward manner and was one of the few diplomats to try to confront the layers of deception head on. In one meeting, she told Zardari, I come here, Mr. President, and talk to you, and then there's a press release and it says something we never even talked about. He looked at Patterson like she'd lost her mind and said, well, you really wouldn't want us to put out what we actually talked about. A similar cycle was repeated in other hotspots where the United States relied on difficult foreign militaries, like Egypt. Panetta said that after his meetings with General Pasha and the ISI, colleagues would often remark, you do understand he's lying. Panetta did. Oh yeah, it wasn't as if I didn't know. You had a pretty good sense. People often ask me why our operations were classified. The reason they were classified is because the Pakistanis wanted them to be classified so that they would never have to acknowledge what was happening. Panetta was laughing again. General Pasha, in his curiously millennial manner, declined to respond to Panetta's comments. "Sorry, Ronan, I am not in it. Let Leon have his say." Accepting Pakistan's double game supposedly safeguarded cooperation. But even at a tactical level, the relationship could be fraught, sometimes for both sides.